Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Professor Frank Castiglia. Professor Castiglia is professor of history at the University of Connecticut, and today we're discussing his latest book, Kennan, A Life Between Worlds, published by Princeton University Press. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much, Charles. I'm very glad to be here. Just one correction. My name is even longer than it seems. It's Castigliola. There's an extra syllable in there. Castigliola, as I pronounce it.
Understood.
Okay.
Professor, why did you write this book?
Well, I thought that George Kennan, I mused about this question actually this morning because that's a question people often ask. I think Kennan's story and Kennan's message is more important now, even than when I wrote the book, started writing the book several years ago. George Kennan was above all a diplomat, someone who had faith in the power of and in the efficacy of people, professional diplomats meeting privately without a hurried pace, people who knew each other's culture, and over time arriving at compromise solutions to seemingly irreconcilable problems. I think that's something that the world could use today. And Kennan had great faith, particularly that the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union could come to a peaceful compromise, and even before it did in 1991, actually didn't come to a compromise then. It came with basically unconditional Soviet surrender, which Kennan disapproved of for many reasons. Let me just finish up one other thing here. Now, of course, many of your listeners will think, well, wait a minute. Kennan is the author of the containment doctrine, of containing, not talking with the Soviet Union. But Kennan regarded the containment doctrine of stopping Soviet expansion, which he enunciated in 1946-47, regarded the containment doctrine as an if-then proposition. If the Soviets were contained, then the United States should move on toward negotiating with the Russians and trying to reduce tensions.
Who was George Kennan by family background?
Well, he came from actually, it's interesting. His mother's family was kind of upwardly mobile people in Milwaukee. His maternal grandfather was someone who set up at the age of 13 and traveled around the world, crisscrossed the seas, seven seas, various adventures aboard ships and so forth, and arrested for a while in a French prison, and came back to Milwaukee and founded a successful insurance company. That's his mother's side, who are the Jameses. His father's name was Kent Kossuth Kennan. He was named after Louis Kossuth, who toured the United States in 1851. The Hungarian revolutionary, and that's when Kent was born 1851. His father was an interesting person who started really as a farm boy who was able to go to college by getting up before dawn and doing farm chores to earn his way. He later became an engineer, a self-taught engineer, and a self-taught lawyer. He also became one of the early U.S. experts on the income tax. And in fact, when the U.S. Congress is debating the 16th Amendment, which enabled the income tax to be established in the United States, Kostas Cannon was one of the people testifying. So he was an interesting kind of person, but I could go into more detail. But that's basically but the two sides of the family did not get along, and it was exacerbated by the fact that Cannon's mother, Florence James Cannon, died only 2 months after he was born. And thereafter, George and his three older sisters remained close to the Jameses, but the Jameses family detested, for various reasons, which I could talk about, detested Kostas Cannon. So young George grew up in basically two households, the Jameses and the Cannons, who were mutually antagonistic.
In subsequent years, Cannon employed a neo-Freudian interpretation to analyze his behavior, especially the dichotomy between Eros and civilization. How much of this do you take on board yourself in your analysis of Kennan's life?
I am not a Freudian. I think that, I make that point. I think Kennan really regarded Freudian theories as settled science, you know, and he's kind of like that. And which, of course, Freudianism was more, the belief of Freudianism was, and Freud's theories, was more pervasive in the early and mid and even late 20th century, certainly than it is today. But as for myself, I don't subscribe to Freud's theories, but I understand and incorporate into my analysis the fact that Cannon did. And so Cannon understood himself in terms of various Freudian ideological or theoretical constructs. One of them being that there was an inherent conflict, polarity and internal conflict within human beings, particularly men, between Eros, by which he meant not just sexual freedom, but also creativity, art, kind of the looser ways of doing things, and civilization, which is duty, obligation, and so forth. And he felt that kind of tug or that division or conflicting impulses within himself, and he attached to those feelings within himself the Freudian concepts of Eros versus civilization.
Why did Cannon go to Princeton, and it was his time there as bad as he subsequently made out?
Well, he was thinking about going to Harvard, and he ended up going to Princeton partly, a good part, because he was inspired by a teacher at his military boarding school who introduced him to F. Scott Fitzgerald, and particularly the novel This Side of Paradise. And time there was I argue in the book that Cannon in his memoirs depicted his years as a Princeton student as basically unrelieved misery and alienation and lack of success. That's not what the letters that Cannon wrote at the time indicated, and particularly letters to his older sister Jeanette, with whom he had a very close relationship with her for decades and confided all kinds of things to her. And those letters, and he wrote many letters to her, indicate that he had a good time much of the time, and he did okay in his studies, and he was not the total oddball that he later portrayed himself as being when he wrote his memoir. And it's interesting that Cannon, when he wrote that memoir in 1967, which is the memoir of his years from 1925 to 1950, He said that he did not bother to go back to look at the letters he had written from the time when he was in college. Rather, he wrote that memoir based on his college years, based on his memory. So I think he had kind of a faulty memory. And Cannon also, with regard to the college years, and Cannon also at times liked to feel sorry for himself. And I think that he allowed that impulse to feel sorry for himself to kind of shape the way he portrayed his years at Princeton University.
Why did Cannon decide to join the Foreign Service and why did he decide to specialize in Russian studies?
Well, he was, after he graduated, or in his last year, he was unsure exactly what to do for a while. He was thinking about becoming a lawyer, as his father was. But he had various, some of his professors had links to the State Department. One of his, George and his three older sisters were close to a next door neighbor in Milwaukee, and that neighbor had ties, had relatives, or I forget the exact relative, but somebody who was in the State Department. So there were some connections, and George had traveled overseas. At the boy of eight, he was brought by his father to Germany, where he learned rudimentary German, and he spent a year in Germany after graduating college. So he liked foreign travel, and it seemed like an appealing thing to do. I mean, it wasn't like a strong, this is one feeling he always wanted to do this throughout his life, but it seemed, he fell into it, but there were some things pulling him into it. Now, as to why he ended up focusing on Russian, the State Department had a program, what we would today call a critical languages program, a program by which the State Department paid its Foreign Service officers, gave them basically a three-year fellowship to learn some language, intimately learn a language that was needed by the State Department for its businesses, Arabic, Russian, Chinese, and so forth. And Kennan chose Russian because the cousin of his grandfather, whose name was also George Kennan, was born also on February 16th, and other coincidences as well. This cousin of his grandfather, George Kennan, had made a national reputation for himself, traveling in Russia in the late 1800s, and writing books and giving lectures. He wrote in particular about the Tsarist Russian penal system of exiling political prisoners in Siberia. He wrote about that, visited those camps, and came back and lectured about it in the United States. It was quite well known. So he's somebody that George Kennan had met once and was kind of, to some respect, a father figure, someone whom George Foster Kennan, the person I wrote about, respected.
Why did he decide to marry Annalisa Sorensen, given their different tastes and interests?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, that who knows? People, you never really know for sure why anyone does anything like that, even ourselves. But one of the things I pointed out in the book is that in the early spring, or mid, I think it was March 1931, Kennan, who had been kind of a playboy, he had dated various women, and he was tall, good-looking, had a steady income. He was an American living in Europe. He was an attractive catch, or an attractive beau. He decided that, well, you know, he says in one of his letters to his sister, he said, you know, this is enough of this bachelor existence. I really need to get married soon. And shortly after that, he met Annalisa Sorensen, who was a young 20-year-old Norwegian woman who was studying in Berlin. And, you know, she was the right person. She was the person he was dating when he decided to get married. I think that's the, in my view, the story. And she was very anxious to marry him. Again, he was a catch. Norway was then a poor country. Her father was a fairly prosperous merchant, but she saw George Kennan as kind of, you know, the exotic appeal of somebody who was an American, somebody who had a good, steady income. There was also the allure of someone who was a diplomat. And so she was eager for the relationship, and he was eager to get married. And so they did. They got married on September 11th, 1931, in Norway.
They did not have a long courtship then.
No, they didn't. And in fact, I think there was a... So Annalisa went ahead before, like, I think in late July or August or something, 1931, went ahead to kind of break the news to her family, get things ready, and George came a little bit later, I think in mid-August, 1931. But she wrote back to him a couple letters, interesting, one indicating that she was a little nervous about that George was really going to follow through in this, and kind of dangled that there was a former fiancé of hers was pursuing her, but she wasn't interested, but hint, hint, George better make it to Norway. And also, she commented at one point, you know, she had to fill out some consular forms for them to register their upcoming marriage. And she said, you know, I really don't know. I don't know when you were born, your birthday. So it was not like they knew each other, I think, extremely well before they decided to get married.
Given his ambivalence about American life and culture and his enjoyment of European, especially German and Russian culture, would you say that Kennan was a Jamesian character?
In some respects, but I mean, he remained an American in the sense that that's where he never thought of, but he did think about living in Europe for a while, and he fantasized about moving back to Europe after he retired. But I mean, Kennan was also a highly ambitious person. Very, very ambitious. And he, of course, his path toward greater influence and rising in the ranks of where he was employed, the U.S. State Department, depended on remaining an American and rising through the ranks of the U.S. government. So that's why the job of a diplomat appealed, because he could do that, pursue his career ambitions, as well as continue working for the U.S. government.
Would it be true to say that Kennan's experience in opening the first American embassy in the Soviet Union was one of the defining moments in his life?
I think that first year that he was in the Soviet Union, he went in December 1933, after Franklin Roosevelt agreed to recognize the Soviet Union. Kennan went as interpreter and aide to William C. Dulles, who was the first American ambassador to the Soviet Union. And that year, from December 33 to December 34, that first year, Kennan was in Russia, was a formative influence, and that was an incredibly exciting time, a time when Soviet society was relatively loose in terms of permitting contact between all kinds of Russian intellectuals and artists and others, ordinary citizens, and the Americans. Kennan led that kind of mixing up with Russians, attending parties and getting close to various Russian junior officials, debating Marxism with them, art, and so forth. That was a wonderful time in his life. And I think also for other, like Charles Bolin, his associate, Charlie Thayer, this was kind of a magical moment, which later when things changed and Stalin began pursuing the purges and things tightened up and relations soured between the United States and the Soviet Union, that year 33 to 34 remained kind of a lost paradise, and it continued to shape the bitterness and the resentment and the sorrow at the loss of what they had experienced during that year continued to influence their lives and influence Kennan, I think, for the rest of his life.
How did Kennan and other Foreign Service officers react to the Moscow trials?
Well, for Kennan, he was there. For at least some of the trials, particularly the trial of Carl Ledeck, whom Kennan knew personally, who attended parties at the American Embassy, an intellectual whom he respected. So Kennan was there. He was assisting the American ambassador, but who at that point was somebody else was the American ambassador. And Kennan was basically attending the trial with the ambassador and whispering a translation of the trial proceedings into the ear of the ambassador during the proceedings, and then spending his nights writing up reports to send to Washington. So he was engaged intensely in the trial, observing the trial. In fact, he watched it so closely that when the proceedings of the trial were reported the next day in the Soviet newspapers and the Moscow newspapers, Kennan picked up on typos or errors. Small errors that had crept into the official Russian account of what he had heard the day before. So and seeing that it was basically, I think it was traumatic for all clearly the victims of the trials, but in a way it was a trauma for Kennan as well, who saw people that he'd been, not just Radek, but the doctor who had saved the life of his infant daughter tried and executed. There were many people whom Kennan knew or respected who disappeared, and that had a profound effect on him.
What were Kennan's political beliefs circa the late 1930s?
Well, that's complicated. I think Kennan was had tendencies, let's put it this way, tendencies in the late 30s toward kind of an authoritarian, preference for a more authoritarian kind of government, even in the United States. I think these views were moderated to a large extent by his experience, subsequent experience, observing what authoritarianism amounted to in Germany and German-occupied Europe and also in the Soviet Union. But he tended to think the government should be, he always continued to think the government should play kind of an important role in making society a better place. And he didn't have much respect for the good judgment of many Americans, whom we saw as basically, you know, confused by advertising, manipulated by politicians, committed to consumerism, you know, not people who were wise in their political decisions. Brennan was an elitist. I think that's an important aspect. He was an elitist. He thought that people, educated people such as himself, people with like ethnic backgrounds, such as he believed he had, these people were best to lead society and certainly to lead and conduct U.S. foreign policy.
What was Kennedy's experience of being in Berlin from 1939 to 1942?
Well, at first he was, okay, so after war was declared in September 1939, Kennedy was went where he had been in Prague for the previous year. He went to Berlin and he was an assistant to the American ambassador there. And Kennan, it was a very intense experience. First of all, the American embassy had a huge amount of work because the U.S. still had diplomatic relations with Germany, and the U.S. was acting as on behalf of other countries that had been occupied by Germany or had broken relations with Germany. So there was a lot of just like daily work to do, which he was involved in. Kennan also, and that this found this out, this was fascinating, Kennan also had secret ties with the Count von Moltke and other German aristocrats who were kind of an aristocratic opposition to Hitler and who had hoped to replace Hitler. And Kennan became quite moved by the cause of this kind of aristocratic resistance to Hitler. And so he kind of pledged to help them. And then the war broke out, and Kennan then was interned in a hotel along with 140 or so other American diplomats and journalists, and Kennan, in effect, became the leader of that American community who negotiated with the Germans about all the details of food and rooms. They were interned in a hotel near Frankfurt, and Kennan was the liaison, basically, between a lot of discontented, unhappy, like Americans with cabin fever, wondering whether and when they would ever get home, and the German authorities who were not sure how far they should crack down on these Americans or not. So these people, there's not that they were tortured, not that they were really in prison. They were confined in a hotel with limited room to exercise. They could go outside just a short distance, and the food was not the best. But there's a lot of grounds for complaint, but not actual misery. And Kennan was a diplomat. He was a diplomat who tried to negotiate and did successfully, I think, the demands, conflicting demands of the Americans he was in charge of and the Germans who were trying to deal with these bunches of Americans while also fighting a war.
Kennan met with President Roosevelt twice. What did he think? Right. What did he think of him?
He did not think, Kennan and Roosevelt really kind of mismatched personalities. Kennan thought that Roosevelt's breezy, I'll take care of it, don't you worry about it, let's change the subject kind of way of dealing with lots of problems. Kennan underestimated Franklin Roosevelt and thought that he was a cipher, that he was just kind of just a BSer when it came to foreign affairs. FDR was far more sophisticated and had far more of a program, far more of a policy than Kennan realized. And I think the personality differences made it difficult for each of them to appreciate the other. Roosevelt, it's not quite clear what Roosevelt thought of Kennan, but clearly he did not think, he thought, respected Kennan, but when it came time to choosing advisors for the Tehran Summit Conference for the Yalta Summit Conference. And Roosevelt did not choose Kennan. In fact, chose Kennan's friend as interpreter, Charles Bolin. And Kennan, that's something that Kennan resented. He thought that he was the expert and should have been at those summit conferences.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Would you attribute that choice more to the fact that Bolin had a greater capability in his career to being on board with official policy, whatever it was at the time, or with the fact that Bolin came from a much more upper crust background, his grandfather and his mother's side being American minister to Paris?
Right. I think all those things. And Kennan, it could be Bolin. Bolin understood that to get along, you need to go along. And so, yeah, I think all those things played a role. And Bolin was also knew Russia well. It was, and, you know, was certainly highly capable.
Now, you fault Kennan for not understanding Roosevelt's policy towards the Soviet Union. Why so, given that scholars such as John Lewis Gaddis, Wojciech Massenet, and Sean McMeekin are equally critical of Roosevelt's Russian policy?
Well, I think that... I think the irony here is that Kennan, by 1945, Kennan and Roosevelt agreed. Although neither realized that they did agree. They agreed that the best solution, given the fact that the Soviet armies had rolled back the Germans and the Soviets were, in fact, occupying most of Eastern Europe, and certainly including Poland and Eastern Germany, Kennan and Roosevelt both thought that the best practical solution was to divide Europe between basically a Soviet sphere and an American-British sphere, Soviet sphere in the east and American-British sphere in the west, and not contest Soviet control over Eastern Europe. That was Roosevelt's policy. That was Roosevelt's policy at Yalta and at Tehran, and what he signaled to the Russians in various times in various ways. And that's what Kennan thought was the best. You know, given the difficult circumstance that the Russians were occupying those territories, that was the best thing to do. Now, I think where I differ with Gaddis and Massenet and some other scholars is that I regard Kennan and particularly Roosevelt. Roosevelt, he's making the policy now, Kennan. Roosevelt's policies as sophisticated and as believing that the important thing was not to allow the collaboration that had grown up during World War II between the Americans and the British and the Russians, not to allow that to deteriorate to a serious degree. There might be tensions and differences, but not to allow the relationship to break down, because that was important for the long-term peace. And also Roosevelt talked about the immediate post-war era as a time of transition, So it was important to maintain contact with the Soviets, not allow relations to deteriorate too badly, and that over time, Kennan, as Roosevelt felt, over time, the Russians would moderate, and their control over Eastern Europe could be made more benign. And also, you have to remember that actual Soviet on the ground control over Eastern Europe got harsher and harsher after 1945 into 46, 47, 48, as relations between the Soviet Union and the West deteriorated. Stalin cracked down more and more as a way of keeping control over areas that had more autonomy. There were elections in Hungary. There were elections in Czechoslovakia, initially after World War II.
Now, there was at that time, I think at the Yalta Conference immediately before, an exchange of or correspondence between Bolin and Kennan, in which case Kennan advocated the policy you described, which was basically spheres of influence, divisions of Europe between East and West, whereas Bolin, in his response, indicated that this was not politically acceptable and had a more idealistic, if you like, view of future Russo-American relations. In that exchange, was Bolin reflecting his own views or views of Hopkins and Roosevelt?
Well, I think, Roosevelt is a very sophisticated person who was also the master of deception. There's a book about Roosevelt's hiding of his disability. It's called Splendid Deception. But Roosevelt, let me just back up a bit. Roosevelt got the United States, involved in World War II by saying he wanted to keep the United States out of the war, but yet taking steps that brought the United States closer and closer to war, cutting off Japan's supply of oil, initiating a naval war with the Germans in the North Atlantic and so forth. Steps and various other things, steps that brought the U.S. closer and closer to war. Similarly, Roosevelt realized that the American public, those Americans who wanted, during the war, who wanted post-war engagement with the world and were not isolationists, those people who wanted post-war engagement in the world, and American people I'm talking about now, had a kind of Wilsonian conception of that the United States should favor democracy in all circumstances, should favor self-determination by small nations, even small nations close to the borders of large, great powers, and that's what the American people favored. Roosevelt talked about that. He talked about that in the Atlantic Charter. He talked about that in terms of the United Nations Declaration. But Roosevelt's actual policies, and what he actually said to Stalin at Tehran and at Yalta was different, was big power, kind of a cynical, but I think realistic, big powers making deals at the expense of small nations. And so, for instance, in Yalta, Roosevelt had the Soviets agree to basically fig leaves of commitments to the Declaration on Liberated Europe and commitments to elections, free elections in Poland, verbal commitments which didn't have any teeth in them. So when Roosevelt hoped would mollify the American public while Roosevelt was fashioning and agreeing to big power deals that were dividing Europe. So I think Bolin, and it's also that, I get involved in, I detail this in a book I did on Franklin Roosevelt. Bolin was also close with Harry Hopkins, and at this point, 1944-45, and Harry Hopkins had shifted away from Roosevelt's policy of trying to make a deal with Stalin. Hopkins had shifted more toward what became Harry Truman's policy and also Bolin's policy after the war of more confrontation with the Russians in Eastern Europe. So it's a complicated matter, but I think that Roosevelt fairly knew what he was doing, and what he was doing is basically, he just used this analogy and other things too, he was backing into, talking about democracy, talking about no big power deals, talking about that in 44-45, but backing into those big power deals while he was presenting a front to the American people. Because he thought the alternative, he thought if the American people realized that he was fashioning big power, kind of cynical deals with the Soviets, the American people would react against that and reject the United Nations, reject international dealings, and the United States would be back to where it was after World War I when the Senate rejected the Versailles Treaty and the American United States to some degree, moved into more of an isolationist stance. Roosevelt realized what had happened to Woodrow Wilson, did not want that to happen to his policies, and thought he could pull it off.
What was the background to Kennan's long telegram, and why are you so critical of it?
Well, I think the long, why am I critical? I think that Kennan was by early 1946, Kennan felt he was upset. He was angry. He was angry with the Soviet government, which, because he was unhappy with the degree of brutality that the Russians are exercising in Eastern Europe. Also, something that was very important to Kennan, very important to him, was the fact that Soviets, secret police were preventing him and other Americans and other foreigners from having ordinary contacts, cultural and friendly contacts with the Russian people. Remember back to the influence of that year, 33, 34. That memory of what had been possible back then stayed in Kennan's mind, the fact that it was no longer possible in the post-World War II period, made him angry. He also felt this is early 46, that he was not being listened to in Washington. He didn't realize that he actually had more influence than he thought. So he's upset with the Soviet government, upset with the American government for ignoring him, not inviting him at Yalta, and kind of getting stir crazy in Moscow. And it's interesting that Kennan loved being in Russia, but every time he was stationed there, after a while, he needed out. He needed out. He couldn't live with the Russians, couldn't live without them. So many things were playing on him in early 46. And when some of his friends asked him, as in the State Department, friends in the State Department asked him to interpret one of Stalin's speeches, February 9th, 1946, election speeches Stalin gave, which is interesting speech in its own right. We could talk about that. Kennan decided, as he put it, now he's going to let them have it. And so he laid out a long, this long telegram, the longest telegram ever sent to the State Department, in which he drew it kind of a fantastical, it's really a fantasy of that he portrayed the Soviet Union as an existential threat to the United States. It was not just the Soviet Union, it was kind of this fanatical political force. Kennan, in this long telegram, kind of dehumanized the Soviet leadership to a fanatical political force. You know, there weren't really people involved. If you look at the long telegram, it doesn't really involve people, it involves forces that are kind of abstract and doesn't involve people with whom you could always compromise with people, but that's not what was presented as the threat in the long telegram. So Kennan laid that all out, Kennan was fantastic prose stylist, was very persuasive language. It claimed to be coldly rational, but used very emotionally evocative language, and the telegram had an enormous effect. The other thing that's important to note here is that Kennan, in that long telegram, presented the Soviets as an existential threat, or this fanatical force, as an existential threat to the United States. And then in the end, in terms of the end of the long telegram, in terms of laying out, okay, what should the United States do in response to that threat, Kennan kind of shifts gears incredibly, to an incredible extent. It says, well, okay, we really don't have to do that much. We just need to basically, you know, help Western Europe recover and improve conditions within the United States. It's kind of like, you know, there's tremendous danger, but we don't have to gear up our military. We don't have to do any of that. Just help rebuild Western Europe and deal with domestic problems in the United States. And then thereafter, when the American officials who read the long telegram, and it circulated widely through the U.S. government, when American officials interpreted the long telegram to mean that the United States had to beef up its military and confront the Soviets with military as well as political and economic weapons, Kennan said, well, wait, you know, I've been misunderstood. I've been misinterpreted. I didn't mean that we needed to militarize the confrontation with the Soviet Union. Just we needed to do the steps I mentioned, rebuild Western Europe and deal with American domestic problems. But of course, Kennan set it up. He set it up unintentionally by presenting an existential threat. Naturally, American officials thought you deal with an existential threat by all means possible, including military confrontation. Not a war, but building up American military forces.
So I take it you'd agree with Lloyd Gardner, one of his early books, Architects of Illusion, where I think he makes the observation about Kennan, quote, in George Frost Kennan, the Calvinist elder wrestles with the Bismarckian realpolitician, unquote.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Now, why was Kennan named as the first head of the State Department's policy planning staff? And what was the nature, presuming he had one, of Kennan's grand strategy?
Yeah, well, he was kind of a wunderkind at this point. So he had been far off Moscow as a junior. It was number two in the American embassy in Moscow. That's February 1946. By April, May 1946, he's brought back to the United States. He was sent by the State Department on a lecture tour of the western parts of the United States in the summer and early fall of 46. And then for 46, 47, that kind of academic year, he gave lectures at the National War College and kind of a brilliant series of lectures laying out American strategy in terms of dealing with the Soviet Union. And then in May 1947, Kennan, who again is regarded as this the Russian expert at this point, the Russian expert. It's Kennan, not Bolin. He's appointed, and he has friends in the Truman administration, particularly James Forrestal, who's Secretary of the Navy, and later the first Secretary of Defense. That long telegram was read, was sent. The long telegram was sent by March 5th, 1946, 2 weeks after it arrived in Washington, which coincidentally was the day that Churchill made his Iron Curtain speech. The long telegram was sent to every American diplomatic post around the world. So that kind of shows you the kind of credibility that Kennan had by that period, 46. And in 47, when the policy planning staff was created, Kennan seemed the logical person to head it up. He had support basically throughout the State Department and through much of the U.S. government. And so he was appointed head of the policy planning staff with a purview, he's now 43 years old, purview of all of U.S. foreign policy, the long-range planning for all of U.S. foreign policy, with an office next door to that of Secretary of State George C. Marshall. So it was an enormous step up from Moscow a year and a couple months earlier to now next door to Marshall's office. And so in that year, particularly 47, 48, and 49, Kennan was highly influential in preparing, he had a staff, but it was largely him, preparing a series of policy planning staff papers, which outlined suggested U.S. policy in a variety of areas around the world. And one thing I should say here is that with something that I discovered when I wrote the book is that Kennan in the 1920s and 30s, back in the 20s and 30s, Kennan had sent into the State Department reports on all kinds of issues, not just related to U.S.-Russia, but all kinds of issues that he concerned himself with. So in a sense, he was preparing himself for the wider role that he got a chance to have in 1947.
Now, in the book, correct me if I'm wrong, at times it gives the appearance that you blame Kennan more than indeed Stalin for the origins of the Cold War.
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I wouldn't say that. No, I wouldn't say that at all. I mean, first of all, the kind of Kennan, even as I said, has his influential role in 1947. He's not in charge of U.S. foreign policy. The people in charge and Secretary of State Marshall and then later Dean Acheson and other officials. So Kennan is not in a position to start the Cold War. Kennan, again, is a fantastic prose stylist. And in the Long Telegram and in the Mr. X article published in Foreign Affairs in July 1947, which repeated largely the arguments of the Long Telegram, in those two manifestos. In those two manifestos, Kennan gave the intellectual framework, the phraseology that American policymakers used in pursuing what was becoming the Cold War. And I noticed just in yesterday's New York Times, the word containment was used again and again with regard to U.S. relations with China. So that kind of Kennan authored the phraseology. If George Kennan had never been born, the Cold War would still have occurred. I don't think you can say that about Joseph Stalin. So why the Cold War occurred, that's obviously a complex question. But basically, as I see it anyway, it occurred because U.S. policy veered away from what Franklin Roosevelt had laid out as basically a U.S. Soviet accommodation, which recognized Soviet control over Eastern Europe. And then immediately after Roosevelt died, Harry Truman shifted policy, and that was clear. The British embassy commented 2 days after Roosevelt died, everything has changed in Washington. So then after that, it was kind of a shot for a shot, punch in the arm, us punching the Russians punching us back, and was a kind of a deterioration of relations that became the Cold War, kind of like what's happening now with the United States and China, where each side is acting in a kind of a provocative way toward the other. So, right, it's a complex issue, but certainly George Kennan is not more responsible than Stalin for causing the Cold War. He wasn't in a position to do that.
Well taken. What I wanted to ask is, there is an appreciable or noticeable diminution of Kennan's influence as Dean Acheson becomes Secretary of State in January 1949. Would you say that Kennan's diminishing influence was caused by the fact that his interaction with Acheson was the interaction of two very different people in terms of how they related to the world and how they related to their atmosphere? Or was the fact that Kennan was not a very good bureaucratic infighter, unlike, say, people like the Assistant Secretary of State for Western European Affairs, John Nickerson, who seems to have bested Kennan in terms of the decision? I think it was Plan B for the division of Germany and the rearmament of Germany.
I think those two factors are important, that Acheson and Kennan, had a kind of a complex, difficult relationship. Kennan was not a good bureaucratic infighter, as good as some other people were. But and then there's also the fact that I think Kennan had George Marshall, who preceded Acheson as Secretary of State. Marshall liked extensive staff work and relied on his staff to a large extent. Acheson did more himself, and I think Acheson regarded Kennan as a rival that Acheson wanted to put in his place. But more important than any of the things we mentioned so far, more important by far, is a difference in policy, and that's the basic thing. And certainly with Hickerson, there was Hickerson versus Kennan was very prominent here. Kennan, as I said earlier, Kennan regarded containment as an if-then proposition. If the Soviets were contained, then the United States should move toward negotiations and compromise and reducing tensions. Kennan believed that by 1948, certainly by 1949, the Russians were largely contained, and they were not expanding their influence further. Western Europe was recovering. The U.S. had closer and closer ties with Western Europe through the Marshall Plan. And Kennan then began, as early as 1948, Kennan began advocating within the State Department for negotiations with the Russians, particularly over trying to defuse tensions over what was going to happen in Germany, divided Germany. And Acheson was against that. Acheson was in favor of the policy that the U.S. would pursue, namely building up Western Germany as a bulwark of support for the United States, what Acheson liked to call situations of strength, building up Japan as a bulwark, as an ally of the United States. Kennan thought that was a mistake. Kennan was ready to move on beyond the Cold War, whereas Acheson was putting policies and steps and institutions. Acheson termed it, later termed his memoir, present at the creation. Acheson was busy creating the institutions and the institutional framework that the United States had during the Cold War, the NATO alliance, rebuilt Western Germany, Japan as an ally, and so forth. Acheson was busy doing those things, and Kennan thought that was the wrong direction to take. So that's the more important difference. It's the difference of a policy rather than the bureaucratic abilities is one thing. But if you have difference of policy, basic difference of policy, the best bureaucratic skills are not going to prevail.
In essence, you could almost say that for Kennan, containment was a means to an end, whereas for Acheson, containment seems to have been an end, almost an end in itself.
That's a good way to put it. And I think, Acheson regarded the free world, that concept, the free world and that political arrangement, economic relation, military arrangement, and the free world as valuable for the United States. And Cannon, Atchison was happy to see the Cold War continue indefinitely. Cannon thought it was dangerous and wanted to bring it to an end.
Why was Kennan's period as ambassador to Moscow so disastrous?
Okay, because I think that, the conflict mostly over policy. Kennan was appointed ambassador to the Soviet Union in the last months of the Truman administration because Acheson and Truman wanted someone in Moscow to kind of reassure the Soviets that the United States did not intend to expand the Korean War into some kind of third world war, as someone to kind of keep an eye on what the Russians were doing. Kennan, by contrast, Kennan was worried that tensions were building between the United States and Soviet Union, and Kennan feared the prospect of an imminent war. And finally, Kennan was opposed to the, but was coming to fruition at this point, the Acheson-Truman policy of creating West Germany as a rearmed ally of the United States, as a nation that would eventually join NATO. Kennan saw that move, you know, that rearming and rebuilding of Western Germany as an ally of the United States, keeping Germany divided. Kennan saw all that as dangerous. And so he basically tried on his own to reach out to the Russians. That did not, that, you know, did not result in any success. He was hampered by the U.S. government. And Kennan, and I said earlier, you know, he found it difficult living in Russia. You know, and the time he was there, he loved it, and yet he was frustrated by it. And by after a few months, after he arrived in May, and by September, late September, he was so exasperated that he made some highly undiplomatic remarks in Berlin and got himself declared persona non grata. He was expelled from the Soviet Union, the only American ambassador even to today ever expelled from Moscow.
Why was Kennan forced out of the State Department by John Foster Dulles?
Well, I think Dulles regarded, well, first of all, when Kennan made those remarks in Berlin, and he said that the restrictions imposed by the Soviets on contact between foreigners and Soviet citizens with regard to what he had experienced in Nazi Germany. But Kennan said that in Berlin, 7 years after the end of the war, again, the Soviets were so angry they kicked him out. And most American officials, including Dulles, saw Kennan as having, this was a terrible gaffe. This was a unbelievably clumsy, stupid thing to say, and I think that further undercut Dulles' credibility, which was undermined by rhetoric because Kennan was trying to suggest, kept on suggesting they go closer to the Russians instead of maintaining the Cold War. And finally, also, the Dulles, in terms of, Dulles was kind of the attack dog. Dulles, along with Nixon, were the attack dogs, as Dwight Eisenhower, the benign ruler of World War II, running for election in 1952. And Dulles was talking about not containment. That wasn't enough. Excuse me. Not containment was too much of a, too passive a policy. Dulles was talking about rollback, rolling back the Russians from Eastern Europe and containment. Kennan's name is associated with containment. So for, I think, personal as well as policy reasons, Dulles didn't want to have Kennan in the State Department and basically fired him. I mean, that's not, he didn't strictly fire him, but he did not appoint him to another position.
What was Kennan trying to say in his 1957 Reith lectures? What was the common Western, official Western response to it?
Well, Kennan was, something he called disengagement. The idea so things were proceeding further from what I just said a few minutes ago. Western Germany, by 1957, was a member of NATO, was rearming, and in 1957, both the Americans and the Russians were on the verge of doing what they later did, which is namely to install nuclear-tipped missiles in Germany. So now you had Soviet and American nuclear-tipped missiles face-to-face, in the heart of Europe, you know, in this narrow confine of on the German frontier. Kennan thought that was that prospect, which was going about to be happening of the approaching those nuclear weapons was incredibly dangerous and unnecessary step. And so this was the brief lectures, which are held over the BBC to an enormous audience, people tuning in to listen. Kennan arguing that, look, we should step back from this mounting confrontation, and we should have it, the West, the Americans and the Russians should negotiate with each other to have a mutual pullback of the military forces from the heart of Europe and to look toward eventually reunifying a neutral Germany that would not be tied with either side of the East and West. Also, this was, would be a way of dealing with became another very dangerous potential nuclear crisis, namely the crisis over Berlin in 1958-59, and again in 61-62. Of course, if Germany were reunited, the valley of Berlin would no longer be divided. So Kennan saw, and then finally he thought there should be some solutions to reduce what was the spiraling atomic arms race. So those were all the factors that Kennan thought were crucially dangerous, very dangerous, and why diplomacy was needed. And that's my initial comment in their interview, that Kennan had a very strong belief in the efficacy of diplomacy to solve, over time, to solve even difficult problems.
Why did Kennan accept the embassy in Belgrade in 1961?
Well, because Kennan, as I said earlier, was a very ambitious man. And it bothered him greatly that he had not been, that Dulles and Eisenhower would not appoint him to any significant job. And he thought, okay, he had a chance to start over again with the Democrats coming in, John F. Kennedy. Kennan hoped for a more responsible position, more important embassy than Belgrade. Kennan would offer to Belgrade or Warsaw, but Kennan chose Belgrade partly because he admired Tito, who was had kind of an independent stance toward Moscow, and Kennan saw that maybe he would be able in Belgrade to do something useful and try to encourage again negotiations, compromise between the United States and the Soviet Union, and he tried. He tried to have a special kind of backdoor channel to Moscow through cultivating the Soviet ambassador to Belgrade, and they did develop a close relationship, but Kennan's efforts to kind of strike out on his own or to be an important vehicle for U.S.-Soviet talks, that effort by Kennan was struck down by Secretary of State Dean Rusk, who saw Kennan as a rival.
What was the gist of Kennan's testimony before the Senate about American policy towards Vietnam in 1966?
Right. This was a kind of dramatic, televised testimony, February 1966, as you say. And basically, Kennan was saying that Kennan, the author of the Containment Doctrine, Kennan was saying that containment did not apply to Vietnam, that containment was the wrong policy to pursue in Vietnam. South Vietnam was not a vital interest to the United States, that the United States was wrecking its prestige and credibility around the world by making war on a small third world country, namely North Vietnam, and that this was not in America's interest. America was pursuing this war, and it was everything that was pursuing that war was counter to American interests. And this was important because Kennan was one of the first establishment figures to come out against the Vietnam War. I mean, he was testifying in his three-piece suit, very kind of austere establishment, conservative appearance, challenging American policy. Yes.
What was Kennan's reaction to the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, Kennan, famous for 1947 in his Mr. X article, had predicted the eventual, as he put it, moderation or collapse of Soviet power. But when it actually happened in 1991, he was concerned that if the Soviet Union fell apart, that the constituent parts of the Soviet Union, the constituent parts of the Soviet Union might go off in their own dangerous directions. He's also worried what's going to happen to all those nuclear weapons that the Soviet Union has. And also, Kennan was, in a way, kind of a bit of a Russian nationalist. He didn't like to see the various parts of the Soviet Union, each go their own way. He was skeptical about the efficacy of independence of Ukraine, and came out and said that. He was skeptical about that. He didn't think the Russians would accept, in the long term, accept an independent Ukraine. For all these reasons, he also sympathized greatly with Gorbachev and thought that Gorbachev's efforts to reform communism and reform the Soviet system, he admired that and feared that the collapse of the Soviet Union would lead to chaos both domestically and in terms of foreign affairs.
More than 10 years after his death, what do you make of George Frost Kennan?
Well, I think... Again, as I said at the beginning, I think the lesson is that the importance of diplomacy. That diplomacy, as Kennan put it, can put what seems to be irreconcilable opposing positions, is just the asking price. The asking price in a bargaining process that is often long, tedious, but if pursued in good faith, can often lead to compromise solutions. I think that's a highly important lesson for us today.
Would you say that Kennan was a man of heroic stature?
No, I don't think so. In terms of like, okay, so where is he a hero? I mean, I think he tried to do things, number of things, which trying to push for an easing of the Cold War, that effort failed. So I don't think so.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor, very much.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.